and welcome to the EU and You. I'm Ellen Gunning, and in this series, I hope to explain the EU and its most important institutions. For this, the first programme in the series, I want to take a look at the history of the EU, how it began and how it's progressed over the years. I'm joined in studio by William Scally, who's worked in industry, worked as an advisor with the Irish government, and now does public policy consultancy. Thanks for joining me, William.
Thank you.
I want to look at the EU decade by decade, if I can, so let me begin with the 1950s. The 50s was a great time of technological advance. The Sputnik, the first man-made space satellite, was launched by the Russians. Bill Haley had us all rocking around the clock, and Jimmy Dean was a sensation in Rebel Without a Cause. At home, Noel Brown, as Minister for Health, was mired in controversy over his mother and child scheme. De Valera was Taoiseach for most of the 50s and became president at the end of the decade. This was also the time when the European Union began life as the European Coal and Steel Community after the Second World War. And it was the first real pan-European cooperation by independent countries. Why coal and steel? Why start there, William?
Well, because coal and steel was considered strategic, and that if countries joined together to jointly develop their industries, that this would help to integrate the economies and prevent conflict into the future. I think that what you just said is fascinating, because you were talking about developments. But in Ireland, it was totally different. The 50s passed Ireland by in the economic sense. And things began to happen in Europe because Europe had been at war, at two wars, 1914-18, 1939-45. We had escaped totally the second one. And in Europe, a lot of the peoples of Europe, and the governments in Europe, felt that we have to try to create a society in Europe that will prevent war ever happening again. And at the same time, we have a threat from Stalinist or Russian expansion from the east. And excuse me, they tried to start with something fairly simple and straightforward, like coal and steel.
And who were the first countries who got involved in that then?
Well, this is the core of the whole thing, really, are France, Germany, who were two of the main protagonists in these wars on mainland Europe, that's distinct from Britain, and then Italy, Belgium, Holland and Luxembourg, and these were the original six who were in on the coal and steel community and who were also the founder members of what is now the European Union, which in the late 50s was known as the European Economic Community, the EEC.
I was going to ask you that, because it started as a cooperation with coal and steel, and then by the end of the 50s, by 57, it was becoming the European Economic Community.
Yeah.
How did it change? What was the main change?
Well, it broadened. There was a treaty. There were all these developments, and other developments in later decades were based on treaties between sovereign states. And the coal and steel community was one. And then you had the Treaty of Rome, which is a famous document. It was the foundation document in the middle 50s of what was then known as the European Economic Community. Now, Britain was involved in those negotiations, decided not to join, and it was left with the original six. And really what they were doing was they were promoting economic integration as a means of developing their economies, as a means of, in a very broad sense, of preventing war and developing social cohesion among people who, many of whom have been enemies for years. And there were trade-offs. They decided to have what was known as a customs union, whereby they would gradually take down tariffs on industrial goods between the six foundation states, and to abolish quotas. That is, quotas are sort of quantitative restrictions on trade. You know, you can only import so many shoes. To gradually abolish all these things over a period of 10 years or so. And at the same time, to set up a special support system for agriculture, which was then important, particularly in France and Italy, as a special support system for rural development or for farmers. And there was a lot of talk in, well, about political union, of seeing some ultimate vision that Europe would be one type of state. Now, that was, among some of the founding fathers, a vision, but they were practical enough to realise that if they ever wanted to get there, they had to start with nuts and bolts And if political union was ever to come, and 50 years later, we're certainly not there, it would take a long time.
It shows a lot of foresight that from the start in the coal and steel industry, they actually moved it into, let's broaden this whole area of economic cooperation. That was towards the end of the 50s. Let me fast forward into the 60s and put listeners in mind of people like Yuri Gagarin became the first cosmonaut in space in the 60s. The Berlin Wall was built to divide communist East Berlin from a free West Berlin. John Paul, George and Ringo, otherwise known as the Beatles, were taking the world by storm. We had the Vietnam War. We had Soviet tanks rolling into Hungary to crush the Velvet Revolution. By 1969, John F. Kennedy was president of America. Nelson's pillar had been destroyed by the IRA. And the Americans had landed the first man on the moon. During the 1960s, the main focus of the EC seems to be on creating a common agricultural policy. You mentioned that agriculture was very important for France in particular. They really developed an entire policy around how they would link agriculture across each of the states, didn't they?
Oh, they did. That was a key component of the first decade or so. And they were also taking down tariffs, and they were also, as I said, removing quotas on trade. It was mainly sort of trade and agriculture. And they were bedding the thing down. And they also came in 1965 to realise that you have to largely have unanimity if there was a vital national interest involved, that you couldn't develop the thing at speed, at one country's speed, if another country on an important issue wanted to go slowly. This was the famous French sort of view in the middle of the 60s. But the 60s were important in the EU also because Britain tried to join, and Ireland made an application as well in the early 60s. And the French, de Gaulle in particular, the French took a view that Britain was too tied to the outside world, too tied to its colonies, and particularly to the United States, to be a full member of what they saw as a European concept. So the first British application, and indeed an Irish application, was in the early 60s, but de Gaulle effectively vetoed it, I think, in 1963.
And what do you mean when you say that they thought they were too tied to their former colonies? It wasn't something they were bringing in with them? They didn't have a European view?
Well, I think that's always been a French, I mean, it's particularly a French view of it, that the special relationship with the United States, which we read about today, that you are too close. You have these worldwide interests and your former colonies and what have you, and you are very close in language, in history, and in some ways in culture to the United States, and you are quite different from mainland Europe. And I think this would have been a French view, sort of then. Now, I mean,
yes,
you can make up your own mind whether it's valid.
It has changed much. The other thing they did in that period as well was that they started to eliminate customs barriers. So
they
began the elimination of borders as we used to know them.
They did, yes. Well, in the sense of trade, of sense of goods, that if a tariff was 20% or something, it gradually came down to naught over a 10-year period or so, yes, that they were doing that, yes. And that expanded trade and helped economic development inside the original six, you know. And then they had a common external tariff, and this is a very important feature of EU then and of the EU now, that the tariff against third countries, which in this context means everyone else who's not in the club or not in what was then the community, and is now the European Union, you have the same tariff, or the same restriction, as it were, against all the outside world in each of these countries that are participating.
If we fast forward to the 1970s, I know we're taking this trip through the history of the EU on speed, but if we fast forward to the 1970s, on television we were watching the likes of Charlie's Angels and Dallas. The Bee Gees made their big comeback with Staying Alive, and Jaws and Star Wars were the two biggest movies of the decades. At home, we had the arms crisis, Bloody Sunday, the burning of the British Embassy, the explosion at Whiddy Island, and at the end of the decade, the Pope's visit to Ireland. And the 1970s saw the EEC expand, with Denmark joining, Ireland, and the UK finally coming on board. What changed between the original, I'm curious about the UK really, in the 50s they had an opportunity to join but they didn't, in the 60s they wanted to but the French weren't keen to let them in. Why did they come in the 70s, and why did we come in with them?
Well, I suppose the simple answer is de Gaulle died, and he had a particular view of France in relation to Britain. But that may be overly simplistic. I think that the view modified about that Britain could you know, mainly at that stage talking about economic sort of cooperation and integration rather than political. So there was a change of attitude in France and in the other countries. And from an Irish point of view, we, you know, had, I suppose, an idealistic reason that we wanted to be part of Europe and our history with mainland Europe. And then, putting it simply, we had a free trade arrangement with Britain, and we were very dependent on the British market. And if Britain was joining the European Economic Community, as then was known, it certainly appeared to be in our interest to do so as well on purely economic grounds. So Ireland and Denmark and the United Kingdom joined in the 1st of January 1973. The Norwegians, interesting enough, you know, had a referendum in the 70s too and decided not to join, and formally. But of course, they had a lot of resources of their own in terms of fishing and oil and so on, and they were farther removed from this. But the 70s then, you had this, the first enlargement, from six became nine, and it moved away from the old core of six countries that founded it originally.
And during the 70s as well, one of the big developments or the big achievements of the EEC, I suppose, was that they introduced the European Regional Development Fund. And the purpose of that seems to have been to help poorer areas and bring everybody up to a level playing field.
Yes, that was the beginning of it. I mean, all these things took time. But as I can remember the middle 70s, the regional policy, that was an exciting development, because I suppose we thought here that we were then certainly... there were a lot of others as well in terms of regions of countries that were underdeveloped, but Ireland was quite underdeveloped by, on average, by compared with the wealth or income levels in the other eight. And we were very interested in that policy, and it gradually developed then that policy in the 80s and in the 90s in a very significant way that it was of benefit to Ireland and indeed to other relatively underdeveloped regions in the European Union community.
The other big change in the 70s as well, of course, was the direct election to the European Parliament.
Yes, I mean, the European Parliament in the early 70s, a consultative body appointed by national parliaments, and it was only had a consultation power, you know, and then there was a lot of was feeling, I think, generally that, you know, the citizens should be involved more, the citizens of individual countries, that this would help them to become better Europeans if there was some representative assembly where they could vote on, that could participate in some important ways in the development of European policy and legislation. And it was thought that direct elections on the same day in every country was at least one way to start trying to do this and to give the Parliament somewhat more powers than they had.
If I can maybe move on from 79 and into the 80s on our very fast trip through the decades. The 1980s, Johnny Logan won the Eurovision with What's Another Year. Cagney and Lacey and Miami Vice were the big hits on the small box. Bungee jumping was introduced for the first time as the major craze of the decade. Lech Walesa and the Solidarity Movement in Poland became household names. Balint Spittle had moving statues. Charlie Haughey was Taoiseach. PDs were formed. Bobby Sands died on hunger strike, and there was a fatal fire in the Stardust. Greece, Spain and Portugal joined the EC. And of course, that was the decade that ended with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the reunification of East and West Germany. It almost feels, with three more countries joining, William, that there was a movement growing where more and more of the European nations were looking to this EEC and saying, look, there is something in it. It's a bit tried and tested. We want to buy into it.
Oh, yes, I think you're right there. We have to remember that it was only democracies that could join, and that, you know, until the middle 70s, that would have excluded Spain and Portugal. And Greece had its period of sort of middle dictatorship as well, at an earlier period. So there were these criteria for membership were further developed as the decades went by, but as a functioning democracy was a basic one. And I think it's true that, and even later in the events of the later decades have shown that a lot of small countries too, small and medium and indeed large countries, there was maybe a feeling, putting it simply, that the EU was the only show in town, and that whatever we may think about its merits and demerits, it's better to be in it than outside of it.
Okay, so it was a club that everybody felt they really should join. They should at least seriously consider joining.
Yes, I think that's correct, certainly, yes.
A few of the things that the EC did at that time, one of them that probably had huge implications in later years, certainly for Irish students, was the introduction of the Erasmus programme, which gave students an opportunity to experience studying in other member states, to experience other cultures and other environments.
I think that's right. I think that the cultural developments were important. I think the 80s also, there was a feeling of the 80s that you needed to move to a new phase. You had done this trade thing and you had done sort of common agricultural policy. That a feeling that you should do something about trying to have more freedom of movement for workers inside EU countries, that you should bring down borders in capital controls, you know, that you should let capital flow freely, that you should begin to pay attention to the environment, that the environment was a genuine European issue. And of course, there was a broader thing that which was always lurking in the background about what one might call security and defence policy or foreign policy, which lurked in the background because a lot of these countries that were now in the European Union were members of NATO, and some, like Ireland, were not. And that issue was beginning to be addressed in the 80s as well. But there was, I think, a feeling that the EU had run a bit out of steam and we need to be doing something additional. And that led to the development of under the leadership of the French president of the Commission, Jacques Delors, to the Single European Act, which, you know, was important in the late 80s and the early 90s in you know, trying to make trade easier, trying to improve, you know, technical standards, all that sort of stuff, trying to get more freedom of movement of workers, freeing up capital movements in the EU, and generally trying to make it more integrated, as well as the beginnings of an environment policy and the beginnings of a more serious address to how foreign policy could be perhaps not run on the same basis as the economic integration was being run, but there could be some measure of cooperation on it.
It was a big sea change, wasn't it, from where it originally started from?
It was. I said there was always this vision of a political union, but I mean that was sort of way up there somewhere. I mean that you were starting with nuts and bolts, and this was a sort of an evolution in the late 80s that you built on more nuts and bolts, you know.
And if we move through a little bit now to the 1990s, the 1990s, we said the 80s ended with the reunification of East and West Germany. The 1990s saw the collapse of communism, an explosion in communications, mainly fueled by mobile phones and the internet. Bill Clinton was in the White House. Tony Blair was in Downing Street. Bertie Ahern was Taoiseach. And Mo Molum was possibly the most popular Secretary of State that Northern Ireland had ever seen. Three more countries joined the EU, Austria, Finland and Sweden. And this was an era of sort of treaties, as far as I can tell, the 90s. There were three major ones. If we begin with the Maastricht Treaty, really, that was about foreign and security policy, or was it?
Oh, to an extent, yes, but it was mainly about what eventually became known as the Economic and Monetary Union, or the euro currency. And it was one of the more visionary parts of saying there was always this idealistic element. And at that time, Mitterrand was president of France and Kohl was chancellor in West Germany. And they felt that European integration should take another notch upwards. And putting it simply, in the early 90s, there was this negotiation then about having a common monetary policy, indeed a common economic policy, but would start effectively with a common monetary policy, that you would have an independent European central bank and you would have a single European currency. This debate was in the early 90s. I mean, it took 7 or 8 years and eventually 10 years before it was finally formalized. Some countries felt this was going too fast, or they didn't want it, notably Britain. And Britain negotiated an opt-out, so did Denmark, and that was allowed, that you didn't have to go at that pace. It was part of the Maastricht negotiations of 1992, and so certain countries in effect were allowed treaty opt-outs, what the Maastricht Treaty did, that it strengthened the foreign policy, you're right on that, and then the sort of procedures for foreign policy, and it strengthened the environment and so on. But the I think that the Economic and Monetary Union, what eventually became the Eurozone, that was the
main thrust of it.
That was driven forward in the early 90s. And the economic and social cohesion, that was developing all the time. The structural funds, we must bring the underdeveloped regions up. I mean, the famous thing in Ireland, you know, that there was a negotiation about the then Irish Taoiseach, Albert Reynolds, negotiated in relation to Ireland. And the headlines, as I remember, there were 6 billion in structural funds or 8 billion, whatever it was, for Ireland.
I remember thinking at the time, that's what the treaty was about.
It was. That was very important to Ireland. But, I mean, for Europe as a whole, it was the Economic Monetary Union was, I suppose, the core sort of concept, because it indicated greater economic integration.
And in 1995 then, I mean, the EU, well, it became the European Union then after Maastricht as well.
Yes.
But the EU really ploughed along, because in 1995 we had the Schengen Agreement, and that actually changed the whole area of passport control. It meant that we could now move between countries passport free as individual citizens.
Yeah, but not for Ireland, because of the special relationship we have with the United Kingdom, and that... You're getting into a sort of very sensitive area here of in terms of the modern development of the EU, about the movement of immigrants and so on. And the Schengen agreement is important for the countries that operate it, but it doesn't there are still, because the British didn't want to be in it, we preferred, it's not that we would prefer, I think, in Ireland, but that we felt we had to have the same sort of system for movement between Ireland and the United Kingdom that was compatible for both countries. And but Schengen was an important symbolic, well, it's reality as well, but it was an important signal on the way, you know. And Austria, and they were richer countries that joined, and you know, the Austrians and Swedes were concerned, had been concerned about neutrality and so on. That was less of a concern for them then. And Finland had been, I think, probably held back earlier by their closeness to Russia and so on, and the Russians might not have wanted them in. But you essentially had three rich countries joining in the middle 90s.
And you also had, at the very end of the 90s, the Treaty of Amsterdam.
Yes, a lot of this was extending things. I mean, it was sort of extending Maastricht, and
that was sort of building on workers' and citizens' rights, really, that had started earlier.
Building on things and going in. Maastricht had these three pillars, which really are now being effectively done away with by Lisbon, where you had a sort of a economic issues which were decided by community institutions, like what they call the community method, and you had foreign policy and cooperation on justice matters, which were decided intergovernmentally by governments. And Maastricht did develop various things, you know, and then we had Nice afterwards. But Nice was really designed to assist enlargement, that other countries, after 1989, you had, when the Berlin Wall collapsed, and just an interesting minor point, you know, East Germany then became a member of, it was West Germany, but it then became Germany and a member of the European Union immediately. But as it turned out in the 90s, most of the ex-communist states in Eastern Europe and other countries then that weren't there, like, you know, Cyprus and Malta and so on, they, in the late 90s, they said, well, we want to join the EU.
Actually, there was a huge movement. That
was yes.
10 countries
was.
Or something at
there
the same
was,
time.
Yeah. There was, yes. And because it was being conceived that membership was open to European countries who were willing to accept what had been done, this is very important, that, you know, when you have these new treaties, there can be transition, new countries come in, there can be transition periods for them to adapt. But the EU doesn't change its basic body of legislation to accommodate them. That's what people call the acquis communautaire, that sort of stays, and then they get transition.
You come into the community at that level, accepting everything that's been agreed.
That's right. And then you, after that, you get transition periods to sort of, before you fully, before certain measures fully apply to you. And then, of course, you see, there was question of the credentials of countries. It was decided that, You know, you had to have functioning democracies, the rule of law, they had to have a functioning market economy, that type of thing. You know, you had to be able to carry out the obligations of membership.
If I can just fast forward you to the 2000s, the noughties. Since 2000, we've seen the introduction of the smoking ban in pubs, the Spire erected in Dublin, the Greens have gone into government for the first time. Ian Paisley and Martin McGuinness became First Minister and Deputy First Minister in Northern Ireland. And as far as I can tell, probably the biggest, to my mind, the biggest change in Europe in 2000 to 2010 was the introduction of euro notes and coins, and the fact that the euro seemed to roll out throughout the European Union, this single currency.
Yes, that was certainly one of them. But I remember that effectively that decision was taken in the early 90s, and it took sort of 10 years to fully
implement. 2000 was really just it coming alive.
Yeah, it coming along. And but that's in reality, the full reality of it was 2002. The other big thing was bringing in 10 countries and then bringing in Romania and Bulgaria. The enlargement, that was huge. Not necessarily in terms of population or in terms of the wealth. I mean, it was the countries, most of the countries who came in at that phase were, in general terms, not as wealthy as those that had been there already. But it was a huge expansion to the east and to the south, and then we had in Ireland. You see, it was interesting because these treaties, Nice and so on, that facilitated all this, needed referendums in Ireland, and the Irish began to vote against these things. And as you know, we had two treaties in Nice, and because it's very important to know this about the EU. You see that these treaties could not go ahead unless Ireland agreed. I mean, Ireland was small, but most countries had ratification procedures for these treaties related to their parliaments and governments, whereas in Ireland, broadly now, and one can argue details about whether referenda are necessary always, but in Ireland the pattern is referendums. And if Ireland says no, well, the Treaty of Nice, as it then was, couldn't come into operation. And similarly, recently, if Ireland said no, the Treaty of Lisbon, as it was, couldn't come into operation. And that became a feature, as far as Ireland was concerned, of what you were calling the noughties, that we began to reject these things, whereas up to then we had always accepted them. We began to reject them and then changed our mind.
And then, yes, yeah. But some people would say, too, that that was a product of the other thing that I hadn't mentioned for the noughties, which was, of course, the Celtic Tiger. Let me close it there, if I can, because we've just come to the end of that programme. It was a very, very fast run through each of the decades of the EU, but I think it will give you a reasonable flavour of how fast the EU has actually been moving, if you look at it in terms of decade by decade. William Scally, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Alan.
You've been listening to 103.2 Dublin City FM. This series was presented and produced by Ellen Gunning. Sound engineering was by David O'Grady. The series was made with the assistance of the Department of Foreign Affairs Communicating Europe Initiative.